This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with some innovations in medicine. And joining us to do so is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Good to see you, Carrie.
You too, Meghna.
I said innovations as a start, but I understand that you want to kick off today with a phrase that you actually describe as terrifying.
Yes, and it's an age-old phrase in medicine, actually in medical education. It's terrifying to me as a patient, but probably very familiar and not so scary to anyone who has gone through medical training, including here in Boston, which is quite a capital of medical education.
Okay, so what is this phrase then?
Okay, here's the phrase. See one, do one, teach one. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's this old, old adage among doctors in training. And what it means is that when you're a green medical student or intern or resident, first you watch a procedure that's being done by someone who knows how. So that's the see one,
okay,
right? Then you try it yourself. That's the do one.
Uh-huh.
And then that may make you such a new minted expert that you're then considered capable of teaching it to someone else. So that's the teach one.
Three steps, okay, and you're an expert.
So that's the adage.
Okay, well, yes. From the patient's point of view, my personal point of view, I can guarantee you that I hope never to be the do one,
mm-hmm,
right? But I imagine, though, that this form of medical learning on actual people, I mean, disconcerting for patients, but what about for doctors as well?
Right, of course. And now, of course, they're being supervised as part of their medical training. But yes, just listen to how Dr. David Scales describes what it was like the first time he had to insert a central line, which involves sticking a great big 8-inch long needle into a patient's jugular vein.
Sliding a needle into someone's neck for the first time is terrifying. I vividly remember seeing the needle right on top of her jugular vein on the ultrasound. I gently pushed, but the needle wouldn't go in. My resident suggested a quick jab to push it through, which at first I thought was crazy, but it worked.
I'm wincing.
I know. And thank goodness it worked, because as we were saying, he was doing this on an actual patient. And by the way, Dr. Scales writes for Common Health.
He does.
Should say that. But
yeah.
Okay, so he was doing the see one, do one, teach one on an actual human being. But Carrie, this is the 21st century. There must be a better way.
Yes, and there is a better way. And David Scales' latest article on Common Health raises the provocative question of whether, in fact, this old idea of see one, do one, teach one, even under good supervision, is so acceptable anymore in an age of rising medical simulation.
Medical simulation.
Right.
Okay. But what does that mean? Because there's all sorts of kind of simulations from actually, you know, the CPR dummies that we've maybe all tried on to, I don't know, we're in the age of virtual reality.
Right. And there is that whole range from super high tech, like virtual reality tools that let you practice, say, laparoscopic surgery, almost like a video game console. It's robotic surgery. And it goes all the way down to low tech stuff like actors playing patients while the trainees practice interviewing and examining them.
I see. And I understand that just last week, a $12 million simulation center was unveiled at Boston Children's Hospital?
Yes, it was. And it's not even the only one in the area. This is a big trend, actually. There's one at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and actually even beyond Boston. I recently visited the UMass Medical School Simulation Center. They call it Experiential Learning, and it is huge. It's 24,000 square feet, and it has crazy stuff. Like, it has a virtual dissecting table that's kind of like, if you can imagine, an iPad the size of a coffin. Like, you can kind of manipulate a virtual patient inside of it. And on a tour for journalists, we're even allowed to watch a simulation with actors playing the parts of a patient who was having a heart attack and his family members who were freaking out because he was on the verge of death.
Huh. So what was that like? I mean, what were they actually simulating in that case?
So they were simulating both. They were doing the resuscitation at the same time they were letting the family members watch and trying to manage them emotionally, so with compassion, but also letting them know that things were not looking good. And meanwhile, the actors were crying and demanding information, and it makes you realize just how hard these situations are. You do have to practice for them. And then, of course, Meghna, sometimes there's just the technical difficulty of some procedures, and also always under the pressure of crisis.
Yeah,
right?
And so all of these things usually going on at the same time, as you said.
Yes, right. So I spoke at the conference recently with Melissa Burke, who's the director of operations for the new Children's Hospital Simulation Program. She showed me a very high-tech brain surgery simulator that was developed with the help of Hollywood special effects experts. It's this very lifelike sort of head and neck of a child with a flap open into the brain for practicing a technique to treat hydrocephalus, or water on the brain.
So that's where the endoscope pierces the floor of the third ventricle. Do it wrong, and it's instant death. And this is why we feel it's so important to have a trainer that's haptically correct. So the first time you do it, is not on a live patient.
Right? Good to practice. Yes. And by the way, haptically means how it feels to your sense of touch, like the kind of material it feels like you're working with.
Oh, and does that include sort of the actual sensation? I mean, I'm imagining, like, you know, speaking of the brain, the pressure that you have to apply.
Right, onto tissue. Yeah. Exactly. So that's the kind of thing they have for individual doctors doing specific procedures. And then there's also this angle of working on the work of team communication. Melissa Burke of Children says that entire teams can practice on these simulators, such as one that simulates putting a baby on a heart-lung bypass.
And the reason is to have an effect on maturing the communication amongst the entire clinical team. It's not just one hero saving the day. It's all about contributors from the nursing staff and the physician staff and the surgical staff contributing all at once.
So, Carrie, I have to say, this makes so much sense, right? I mean, we're talking about life-saving procedures that, if they go wrong, could cost a life. I love how teams are also doing the simulation because they need practice on how to talk with each other and patients. Makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. And to not do it on live people before you're good at it.
Hello.
I mean, underline.
Yes.
But, change is hard in any world. Is there any resistance to this movement?
So there's no one saying, oh, simulation is bad. But first of all, not everything can be simulated, right? And then there's, of course, money. Simulation costs a lot, not just to build, but to run.
I mean, we're talking millions of dollars beforehand, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And also, that was to start it up, but also for your annual budget, because you need to run it, you need staff. And David Scales, who wrote our Common Health piece, we heard from him before, he cites a survey that found that a simulation center usually costs more than $500,000 a year to run. And by the way, you also need doctors who are humble enough to use the trainers because, unlike pilots, they're not required to do simulation to keep their licenses. I spoke with Dr. Antonio Gargiulo. He's the medical director of the Center for Robotic Surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he predicts that this will change. He says, right now, simulation is kind of like a movement within medicine, and physicians only simulate because they think it's the right thing to do. It's their own sense of ethics.
And say, okay, guys, from now on, you know, if you want to work in this cardiac room, you have to simulate. Okay. At some point, this will come from third-party payers, including the government.
So in other words, he's saying the government and the health insurers who pay for our health care will require this. They'll make it compulsory the way it is for pilots because it's better for patients and also, frankly, for the bottom line.
Okay, well, speaking of patients, after hearing all this, I mean, I imagine that perhaps some of the demand will come from patients themselves.
Right. Here's what Dr. Gargiulo says.
Patients practically will demand that everybody that will be touching them at any point or making decisions regarding their health has actually encountered the problem before. At least they want to have the comfort that nobody is winging it.
Nobody is winging it.
Right?
Yes, yes, and yes, we all want that comfort. But until then, Carrie, what should we as patients do in the meantime?
Right, until then. So it seems like there's no way around having an awkward conversation with your doctor or your surgeon. And from David Scales, who wrote this piece on Common Health, I learned the catchphrase, are you current in this procedure?
Okay.
Which I guess is a way of saying, do you do this fairly often? And Meghna, I can certainly imagine you going in there and saying, how many times did you simulate this and what were your scores? Right?
I try to keep my radio self out of the physician's office, but perhaps, yes, I would say that. I mean, and Carrie, it just occurred to me that when you consider last week's news, I know Common Health covered this, that medical errors may be the third biggest cause of death in the country. These are questions I feel like they're well worth asking your doctor.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we already know that in general, it's good for a doctor, like, say, a surgeon, to handle dozens of cases like yours per year to be really up to speed. And I guess, you know, having read David Scales' piece, I guess I'd count simulations if it's something that can be simulated.
Well, Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to the article she's talking about. It was written by Dr. David Scales. The link is at our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you so much as always.
You're welcome, Meghna.
We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Mm-hmm.